From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and President Obama will visit Dallas tomorrow. He is expected to speak at an interfaith memorial service as the investigation into the shooting deaths of four police officers and a transit officer in Dallas continues. And demonstrations and marches by people protesting the fatal shootings of two black men by police last week are also expected to continue, including one scheduled for this afternoon in Sacramento.
We'll, of course, watch for news about last week's shootings, but it's Monday and the calendar is full, and we're a week away from the Republican convention in Cleveland. Donald Trump's VP pick could come any day now. Hillary Clinton will be in New Hampshire tomorrow with Bernie Sanders. Sources tell NPR that an endorsement is expected there. And of course, both candidates will undoubtedly continue to respond to the violent images we've all been watching. So let's take a look at the week ahead with NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Robin.
And how sure are we that an endorsement is coming tomorrow?
We don't have a guarantee, but, you know, it's the time and it's the place. And the platform is all but done. That's what Bernie Sanders has been talking about being a little bit hung up on. He wanted to make sure the Democratic Party would join in his crusade, in his fight for the middle class. And he's won a great deal in this platform down in Orlando over the weekend. They were hammering this out. And, you know, he got a lot of what he wanted. A $15 minimum wage is supported in there. Access to higher education for working class families, and a lot of stuff on healthcare policy as well. So, you know, it's the time. We've gotten a lot closer to the actual convention in Philadelphia, and tomorrow in New Hampshire, well, New Hampshire being the first state to have a primary, it's kind of a good place for a new beginning.
Yeah, well, tell us about this, because a few weeks ago, he did say, you know, we're going to take this fight to Orlando. A lot of people might not have understood that, but as you said, that's where the entire platform committee was meeting and hammering out the planks on the platform. And he was determined to win some of them. And as you say, he did.
Yes, he has. And this is particularly important, I think, with respect to health care. The public option was debated back when Obamacare was first put together, and the Democrats didn't feel that they could push that far. Bernie Sanders was certainly one of the people who did want to go that far, and so was Hillary Clinton. She has been a fan of the public option in the past. I believe she committed to it as far back as February. So it was important to get that in the platform, but also the commitment to making it possible for people to go to college who don't have money, and that is something that a lot of young people have found it was necessary to take on enormous debt in order to accomplish. This is something Bernie Sanders cares a great deal about. So for him to get all of that was meaningful. But, you know, it's also the calendar and the political calculations, because the two political conventions are about to begin, the Republicans in Cleveland, the Democrats in Philadelphia. Division looks bad at this point. The Republicans have a lot of problems with that. And Sanders has always had to balance things between the independence that's so important to his political persona and his obligation to his supporters and his desire to defeat Donald Trump and promote the party that he's closer to. And that is the Democrats, right, even though he remains technically independent.
Speaking of whom, Donald Trump's vice president, what's the latest?
The latest is that Lieutenant General retired Michael Flynn told ABC yesterday, when asked about a couple of social issues, that he is pretty much 100% totally pro-choice on abortion and also has no problem with same-sex marriage. Immediately, the Twitterverse lit up with a lot of conservative groups and activists saying that's unacceptable.
Yeah.
If Donald Trump picks this guy, I don't care what his national security credentials might have been, and he was the head of the Defense Information Agency, or excuse me, the Defense Intelligence Agency for some period. So they don't care. All they care about is the social issues, and he was wrong in their view on these big issues. So the boomlet for Michael Flynn appears to be over at this point. Of course, we know a lot of senators have taken themselves out of consideration. Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana in a tough reelection fight there, is still interested, and he has been with Trump recently. No real judgment has come from either one of those two people after that meeting. And we also still see Donald Trump campaigning with Newt Gingrich and Chris Christie, and he seems to be comfortable with both of them and keeps campaigning with them.
Yeah. Just very briefly, I want to touch on Congress. In the Senate, a bill is expected to pass to combat heroin and painkiller abuse, something Democrats and Republicans are united for. But we're understanding there's going to be a flurry of bills that might help some Republican senators who are up for reelection and some feel might be, you know, drawn down by Trump.
At this point, there are a lot of senators who are worried about the reelection prospects, of course, but in particular, Senator Portman from Ohio, Rob Portman, and Senator Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire have really gotten their shoulder behind this heroin and opioid painkillers bill to try to do something about the epidemic that's killing so many people across the country. And so they've really put it on the line for this. And while the Democrats feel in the Senate there should be more funding, it passed overwhelmingly in the House, and I don't think it's going to get hung up in the Senate on the funding issue.
Yeah. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. We're also seeing reports that the Democrat Evan Bayh is going to enter the Senate race in Indiana. He's the former governor of the state. He also served in the Senate for 12 years. So it could be a very exciting week. Ron, thank you as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And from U.S. politics to politics in Japan, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is claiming victory after yesterday's parliamentary elections, and the results are seen as a boost for Abe's efforts to revise the country's pacifist constitution and also stimulate the economy. Joining us by Skype from Tokyo is Stephen Nagy, professor of international politics at the International Christian University. Professor Nagy, remind us first, how does Prime Minister Abe want to change the constitution?
Well, currently, Prime Minister Abe and many of his conservative supporters see the Japanese constitution as not being realistic in terms of Japan's current and future security issues. And I'm specifically speaking of North Korea and, of course, Chinese assertive behavior in both the East and South China Sea. So he would like the Japanese military to behave in a more normal fashion, so be able to respond independently to aggression or assertive behavior by potential threats, whether they be North Korea or Japan. So by changing Article 9 of the Constitution, Article 9 basically says that Japan gives up the right to project power to engage in war. So this is what he would like to change in the Constitution, and this is why it's so controversial, because Japan's post-World War II identity has been very much centered on this idea of pacifism, right, and rejecting the idea of war as being a way to solve international problems or relations between states.
So would the people of Japan be with him on that if he decided to make that change?
Poll after poll says that people are supportive of change if it means protecting the immediate archipelago of Japan. If it means projecting power or sending troops far abroad or even into the South China Sea, the support is very, very tepid.
And what about on economic policy? This is a prime minister who even has a kind of economics named after him, Abenomics. He's been trying to stimulate the Japanese economy ever since he took office. What might he do now because of this result?
My sense is that individuals that have been elected to the upper house are strongly supportive of focusing on the economic policy, doubling down, as the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, says, on Abenomics. That means more intervention by the Bank of Japan, and that means more structural change. So not only adopting and implementing the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but really engaging in structural reform of the Japanese economy so that Japanese businesses can be more efficient, more profitable, more flexible, more dynamic, and be able to compete with not only businesses within the region, but globally.
Is the sense in Japan that Abenomics has been working?
Actually, it depends. If we look at the young people that were just included in the election, the 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds, many people see Abenomics as moving in the right direction. If we look at NHK, the Japanese National Broadcasting System's polls, 60% of individuals that are 18 and 19 are supportive of the policies. What we see, those people that are against the policies are those people that are embedded in the traditional workplace, embedded in the traditional process of lifetime employment. So those vested interests that for them, Abenomics and structural change and the Trans-Pacific Partnership means a dramatic transformation of their lifestyle. So again, we see pockets of individuals that are against Abenomics and many sectors of Japanese society that feel that Abenomics is the right direction and most likely the only path forward for Japan at this stage.
What does Prime Minister Abe's victory mean for the other countries in the region and for the United States?
First of all, I think it means more continuity in terms of foreign policy, and this is very important. Japan had a long period where you've probably seen those sushi trains that keep moving on, where we have a different piece of sushi moving on. Well, that's what the prime ministers were like. So we had a different prime minister every year. So we had no continuity in terms of foreign policy, economic policy, and political policy. So Prime Minister Abe being reelected with in such a strong position means that we have much more continuity. For the Southeast Asian countries, they see more stability, more investment in Southeast Asia, and more cooperation in terms of security, economics, and politics to deal with some of their struggles within the region, in particular their territorial struggles with China in the South China Sea. So again, I think we can look at the area in terms of Northeast Asia and Southeast Asia somewhat differently. South Korea presents a particularly interesting example because Prime Minister Abe started in such a terrible point in terms of South Korean-Japanese relations, but he's made some real progress in terms of the comfort women issue, some military cooperation with South Korea. So we can look at it in many different ways in terms of economics, politics, and security.
That's Stephen Nagy, who is a professor of international politics at the International Christian University in Tokyo. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. We'll see you again.
Hundreds of people were arrested over the weekend during protests in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, St. Paul, Minnesota, and a number of other major cities around the country following the police shooting deaths of two black men last week, just the latest in a string of similar incidents that have gotten national attention. On Tuesday, Alton Sterling was shot and killed in Baton Rouge. He was selling CDs outside a convenience store when police responded to a 911 call alerting them to a man with a gun. Two officers pinned Sterling to the ground, and then at least one of them shot him.
They shot him?
The next day, Philando Castile was shot in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, after being pulled over. His girlfriend said he was stopped for a broken taillight. She streamed the immediate aftermath of the shooting on Facebook Live.
Please, officer, don't tell me that you just did this to him. You shot four bullets into him, sir. He was just getting his license and registration, sir.
And as we know, that incident was followed the very next day by what happened in Dallas. Five police officers killed and seven others injured, along with two civilians at a Black Lives Matter demonstration. Well, it has been nearly 2 years since Black Lives Matter became a real national presence, with major protests in Ferguson, Missouri.
You must disperse immediately. Now, this is an order. We're subject to arrest and other actions.
That was in August 2014, after a black 18-year-old named Michael Brown, who was unarmed, was shot and killed by a white police officer. His killing sparked weeks of protests and unrest in Ferguson and around the country. At the time, we spoke to a St. Louis DJ, Boogie D, about what he was hearing from people in the community.
The protesters want a lot of things to happen. First and foremost, they want Officer Wilson charged for murder of Michael Brown. The second part of the conversation is people now want to say, what are we going to do? Because this is the situation that led to why everybody's out in the streets now, is they're just tired of dealing with these police departments.
Well, in November of 2014, a grand jury decided not to indict Officer Darren Wilson for murder, and riots broke out in Ferguson. The next morning, I met up with Terry Willits at a ConocoPhillips gas station on a street that was still smoldering. The station had been destroyed, though the gas pumps were still intact. I asked her if she was surprised at what had happened.
It doesn't surprise me. I think everybody made it clear that this was the way they were going to get their message out. And you know, I'm all about getting your message to the people, but it's hurting them now.
A month before Michael Brown was killed, there was Eric Garner. New York police approached Garner on a sidewalk in Staten Island in July of 2014 for apparently selling loose cigarettes illegally. One of the officers, Daniel Pantaleo, put Garner in a chokehold, a maneuver banned by the NYPD. And as police held him down, Garner kept telling them over and over, "I can't breathe," which you can hear on a recording taken by a bystander.
Put your hand behind your back.
Garner did not get the medical help he needed, and he died a short time later. A grand jury decided not to indict Officer Pantaleo. "I can't breathe" became a protest slogan. Then, in November 2014, there was Tamir Rice. Rice was just 12 years old, and he was playing with a toy gun at a park in Cleveland when someone at the park called 911 to report a man with a gun. Police officers arrived on scene, and within seconds, they opened fire, killing Tamir Rice. 5 months later, we spoke to Rice's mother, Samaria, about her son's death and the killings of other Black Americans by police.
You know, I don't want to really think that is racism, but, you know, I just keep seeing the same thing over and over again, and I'm wondering, where are they getting these officers from? Like, where are they coming from? I mean, are they passing a test?
In December 2015, a year after Rice's death, prosecutor Tim McGinty announced that no charges would be filed against the officers. He called the shooting a perfect storm of human error, but said no crime had been committed.
The Supreme Court instructs us to judge an officer's conduct by what he or she knew at the moment, not by what was learned later. We are instructed to ask what a reasonable police officer with the knowledge he had would do in this particular situation. The Supreme Court prohibits second-guessing police tactics with 20/20 hindsight.
After that announcement, we got reaction from Walter Madison, an attorney for Rice's father.
Very disappointed. My disappointment largely for Tamir's father and his grandmother. These are human beings who lost a 12-year-old child, and the timing of this news during the supposed most joyous and peaceful time of the year is very disturbing.
Rice's family later settled a wrongful death suit against the city of Cleveland for $6 million. In that settlement, the city did not acknowledge fault for Rice's death. Less than 6 months later, there was Walter Scott, who was pulled over in North Charleston, South Carolina, for a broken brake light. After he was stopped, he got out of his car and started to run away. That's when Officer Michael Slager shot him 8 times. Here's Slager calling the incident into the police dispatcher.
220, just got shots fired. Subject is down. You grab my taser.
Slager was eventually charged with murder after a bystander video came out that showed him shooting Scott in the back as Scott was running away. I spoke with Al Cannon, the Charleston County Sheriff, later about the shooting.
Well, I think events around the country have certainly put us to the task of looking at what we do and how we do it and making some adjustments in terms of how we interact with the community.
Officer Slager is currently awaiting trial. The same month Walter Scott was shot and killed, April of last year, 25-year-old Freddie Gray was arrested in Baltimore for having an illegal switchblade. He was handcuffed and put in the back of a police van. A week later, he was dead from a severe spinal cord injury that he apparently sustained in that police van. Gray's death set off major protests in Baltimore. And less than a month later, state's attorney Marilyn Mosby made this announcement.
The findings of our comprehensive, thorough, and independent investigation, coupled with the medical examiner's determination that Mr. Gray's death was a homicide, which we received today, has led us to believe that we have probable cause to file criminal charges. Yes! Yes!
Her office filed charges against 6 police officers, and since then, 2 of those officers have been acquitted. A third trial ended in a hung jury, and a 4th officer is on trial right now. Then, a couple months after Freddie Gray, there was 28-year-old Sandra Bland. A Texas state trooper pulled her over for allegedly changing lanes without using her turn signal. Dashcam video of the stop shows the interaction between her and Officer Brian Encinia escalating quickly after the officer asked Bland to put out her cigarette and she refused.
Get out of the car now.
Why am I being apprehended? You're trying to give me a ticket.
I said, get out of the car.
Why am I being apprehended?
I'm giving you a lawful order. I'm going to drag you out of here.
So you're going to drag me out of my own car?
Get out of the car.
And then you
I will light you up. Get out.
Wow.
Now.
Wow.
Get out of the car.
Really, for a failure to signal. You're doing all of this for
get
a
over
to signal.
There.
Right, yeah.
Officer Encinia arrested Bland for assaulting him, and 3 days later she was found dead, hanging in her cell. The county coroner classified her death a suicide. But her family, friends, and many activists around the country still have a lot of questions about what really happened and say she should never have been arrested in the first place. The officer who pulled her over was fired, but he was not charged. Neither was anyone else. And then in November of last year, Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke was charged with first-degree murder in the 2014 shooting death of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. Van Dyke shot McDonald 16 times within seconds of getting out of his police car as McDonald was walking away from him. The officer was only charged 13 months later, on the same day that a graphic dash cam video of the shooting was made public. Van Dyke is currently awaiting trial. And in December, Attorney General Loretta Lynch announced an even broader federal investigation.
Today, I'm here to announce that the Department of Justice has opened an investigation into whether the Chicago Police Department has engaged in a pattern or practice of violations of the Constitution or federal law. Specifically, we will examine a number of issues related to the Chicago Police Department's use of force, including its use of deadly force, racial, ethnic, and other disparities in its use of force, and its accountability mechanisms.
Attorney General Loretta Lynch speaking there. And those are just some of the more well-known cases of Black Americans who have been killed by police in the last couple of years. In fact, according to a Washington Post database, 115 Black men are known to have been shot and killed by police this year alone.
And this news today about one of those shootings, the fatal shooting last week of Alton Sterling outside a convenience store in Baton Rouge. District Attorney Hilaire Moore III said today that he's recused himself from the investigation because of a personal relationship with the parents of Blaine Salamone, one of the two officers involved in the shooting. Both of Salamone's parents are longtime law enforcement professionals with senior positions in the Baton Rouge Department. D.A. Moore said a new prosecutor will be appointed to oversee the prosecution of any criminal charges that might arise. And the race is on in online retail sales. Walmart is offering free shipping this week, getting rid of its $50 spending minimum. It's also offering deals on everything from toys to HD TVs and Xbox One consoles. It is a counterpunch to Amazon's annual shopping day, Amazon Prime Day, which is tomorrow. Are you wearing your party hat? Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money, joins us. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And Prime Day is a big day for a lot of people. Walmart tried to compete with it last year. They lowered the spending minimum that qualifies for free shipping. Now they're getting rid of the spending minimum. What's going on? Are they losing customers to Amazon?
Well, I don't know if they're losing. It's just that they're losing the battle to Amazon. And, you know, if you look at the projections in the next 5 years, it looks like Amazon is going to actually dominate online sales, maybe taking up to 60% of all sales. It's unbelievable. So Walmart's trying to strengthen its e-commerce business. They have been trying to do so for a few years. But you know what? They saw an increase of 7% of sales on their website and their mobile app in the last quarter. But that's down from 17% a year ago. So yeah. I think this is maybe a little kickstart.
Well, let's explain to people they have these services, but you pay for them. Walmart offers the competitor to Amazon Prime. It's called Shipping Pass. It's unlimited two-day shipping. It's $49 a year. That's less than Amazon Prime's $99 a year, but the Prime membership includes video streaming and other things. So what more? I mean, how is Walmart doing in matching Amazon?
I think they're kind of losing the battle, and I know that they are going to keep trying, because honestly, let's look at the big picture here, right? Total retail sales last year were about $4.7 trillion, right? But, you know, that includes automobiles and gas. So if you take it out of there, you would say, you take those big categories out, you'd say that online is still a small percentage of the overall. So when you say, like, big picture, Walmart's doing just fine. It is still the world's largest retailer, and online sales are growing much faster than the brick and mortar sales, but still, brick and mortar sales are pretty awesome. It's very clear, though, that Walmart is trying to really put an emphasis. I don't think they believe they're going to beat Amazon. They just want a share of that pie. You know, my former boss, Neil Ash, he used to run CBS Interactive, now runs Walmart's global sales and that whole division. And I know that he is hyper focused on saying, just give me a bigger piece of the pie. It doesn't have to be the whole pie.
Yeah, we talk about this fight over free shipping. Is it really free, or does the price rise?
Well, you know, look, there are ways to check that. So I feel like we're smarter consumers. I think what a lot of these programs do, however, is it encourages us to actually spend so much more than we would have. And we know that Amazon doesn't give us specific numbers, but what we do know is that Amazon Prime customers spend about twice as much as the other customers. And I have a feeling that Walmart sort of says, hey, wait a second, if we hook them into this free shipping, they'll spend more per customer. They're better customers. And that's obviously what they're trying to do, is capture a larger share of our wallets.
Okay, but do we really need another shopping holiday?
Well,
really?
I know. Okay, so it's July, and I'm from New York. We used to have Crazy Eddie, and he would say, Christmas in July. And so it's sort of an old-time scheme just to get people there. I will also note, by the way, that back-to-school discounts are starting. You ready? This week.
Okay.
I know, that's frightening.
Just remember, people, it's a scam to get you to buy. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks so much.
Take care.
10 more states are stepping into the fray over transgender rights in schools. Nebraska Attorney General Doug Peterson filed a lawsuit on Friday with 9 other states suing the Obama administration over its requirement that schools allow transgender students to use the restrooms that correspond with their gender identity. The total number of states challenging the ruling is now at 21. Joining us now is Nebraska's Attorney General Doug Peterson. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And why did you file this lawsuit?
We were concerned. We've been concerned in other areas that certain federal agencies have attempted to broaden the scope of a law without going through either the Administrative Procedures Act or other processes that have been developed, basically complying with the rule of law. And so because this letter issued May 13th was another attempt to broaden the scope of a law, without following that process, we felt the lawsuit was necessary.
But why shouldn't, in this case, Title IX be interpreted the way that the administration is currently interpreting it, defining sex and allowing that to include transgender people who the administration believes should be able to use, for example, the bathroom that corresponds with their gender identity?
Because the legal process requires that if you're going to broaden the scope, and this has been around for a long time, Title IX and it's been around, and Title VII have been around since the 70s. There have been attempts to broaden the scope of its application, because when you look at the legislative history, it was clear that the use of the word sex meant male, female. So when you try to broaden the scope, the appropriate place is to do that through legislative amendment, and they've attempted that. That has not worked. The courts have defined, both in Title VII and Title IX, not to broaden the scope in the way that's being suggested in this letter. And so there is a process, and I think one of the things, Jeremy, people need to understand is there may be steps taken by administrative agencies that people agree with philosophically. They feel it's appropriate. The fact of the matter is there is a balance of power. There is a process that allows the ideas to be fully fleshed out and not to allow an agency to unilaterally act. So in certain situations, some citizens may say, well, gee, I think it's fine, I'm comfortable with it. But there'll be other times when an agency will do something like this. You'll say, whoa, wait a minute, I don't agree with that at all. And you have to follow process.
Well, in this case, do you agree or do you disagree with it just yourself?
That doesn't matter. What I did is I took an oath of office. And what I had to do was to make sure that the rule of law was complied with, whether it's regardless of what my personal philosophy is. What I have to do is to make sure that the rule of law is complied with. And so in this particular case, they understand that there have been laws passed, including the Administrative Procedures Act, that say if you're going to make a change like that, you have to notify people and you have to give opportunity for comment. You can't unilaterally act. So, frankly, this is my responsibility under my oath to make sure the Constitution is complied with.
So you're saying if Congress were to actually pass a law that had similar implications, you would not fight that?
Exactly. Exactly. Because that's not my role. That's the balance of power that the Constitution set forth that says that's where this change is supposed to occur.
Have you had any incidents in Nebraska since the directive in which a student used a bathroom of their gender identity and there was a problem?
You know, the way, in my discussions with Nebraska school administrators, it's very clear to me what they've been doing is when this issue has arisen, and it's a very rare situation, but when situations like this arise, what they do is they bring in the parents, they bring in the health care providers, and the child, the student. And there is basically a plan developed that respects both the privacy of the student and also the needs of the other students in the school system. And to me, it seems to be a very, very reasonable approach. But that I have not had any issue brought to the Attorney General's office where some conflict has existed.
So why then file this lawsuit beyond just you don't want the administration, the executive branch, to do something without Congress stepping in? So you're saying there's not actually a problem at the moment in Nebraska. This is just a philosophical issue that you have with this.
It's more than just philosophical, because it's been made very apparent that the Department of Justice and the Department of Education intend to use the hammer of funding by withholding, and we receive over $300 million in Nebraska in our school systems of Title IX funding. So they've said very clearly, and they've enforced it in areas like Palatine, Illinois, where they've made it clear if you don't completely embrace the directives in the May 13th letter, that we will withhold funding. And the state of Nebraska happens to have, we run a juvenile center for both girls and boys, with both junior high, high school level. So we have that current situation, and the other school districts all rely upon, the public schools rely upon Title IX money. So when you issue a letter taking this unilateral action to redefine or broaden the definition of sex and tell schools that they have to comply with it or they will have Title IX money revoked, that's a real and present action.
What do you make of comparisons between this, though, and what happened in the 60s and desegregation of schools and the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare using that to threaten some southern localities with the loss of federal funding if they didn't integrate their schools? Because some people look at them and say it's the same principle, basically. The federal government is saying we want to make sure that everybody is treated fairly, and if this is the way we have to do that, then this is the way we'll do it.
Jeremy, I just have to do what my role is as Attorney General, is to stand by the oath that I took. And so when I see a process that is being applied in 2016 that I believe is outside the rule of law, that's the one I have to address. And I can't really try to make comparisons with the 60s.
Do you think this is going to end up at the Supreme Court?
I think it will. I'm not certain of that, but I think there's a potential it will.
That's Doug Peterson, Attorney General for the state of Nebraska. He has just filed a lawsuit along with 9 other states to fight the Obama administration's ruling on transgender bathrooms. Doug Peterson, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, at this point, you've probably heard about Pokemon Go. It's a new smartphone game that officially launched last week. And while the numbers aren't out yet for iPhone users, the latest estimates say the game is already more popular than Tinder on Android phones and may soon overtake Twitter. It's based on the popular 90s video games and trading cards, which center on catching and trading fictional creatures called Pokemon. The new game has the same basic premise, with the exception that players are forced to get off the couch and go find Pokemon hidden in the real world. This morning, we followed the game's GPS outside and across the busy street to our first Poke stop. 22-year-old Emily Palmer was waiting for a walk signal with the game out. She is a level 4, whatever that means, and has her own strategy for catching Pokemon.
I mostly do these in Ubers, because it's kind of fast. You get around. I've gotten, like, all of my Pokemon through Uber.
Probably a better idea than walking around while playing. There are some concerns that people aren't looking where they're going when they're doing that. Now, the game is free with some in-app purchases, and it makes use of augmented reality, meaning that when you reach a Pokemon, the game uses the iPhone's camera or the Android phone's camera to show your real-life surroundings while superimposing the creature in the sky, by the water, and in the street. You can only imagine what those sounds are. The user throws Pokeballs to capture things like a Zubat or a Snorlax or a Weedle. and the type of creatures tends to vary based on your location and geography. The game tries to send users to landmarks like monuments and parks in search of the creatures. One soon-to-be father found a Pidgey sitting next to his wife while she was in labor. Pokemon Go has topped the U.S. App Store's charts, and Nintendo's shares in Japan surged today, closing up nearly 25% and adding about $7.5 billion to its value. Now, so far, Pokemon Go is only available in three countries, the U.S., New Zealand, and Australia, so it could get a lot bigger before all is said and done. By the way, a couple of weird things that have happened with Pokemon Go, according to ABC affiliate KTRK, in Wyoming, Shayla Wiggins was playing and discovered a body lying in a river while looking for creatures. And in Missouri, four teens were arrested for allegedly waiting at Pokestops to rob people. How nice. You're listening to Here and Now.
And much has been said in the last week about how, if we are to get through this painful, convulsive moment in our country's history, we're going to have to listen to each other more, be more empathetic to other people's experiences. Well, if you remember your favorite teaching moments from either the book or movie version of To Kill a Mockingbird, it might be the scene where Atticus Finch, played in the film by Gregory Peck, tells young Scout, played by Mary Badham, to be more open to other people's stories, to never judge a book by its cover.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view.
Sir?
Till you climb inside of his skin, walk around in it.
Let's take that idea a bit further today with a look at how virtual reality is being used to change perspectives and increase empathy. Todd Bookman from The Pulse at Here Now contributor WHYY in Philadelphia has more on this shape-shifting technology.
The headset kind of looks like a pair of ski goggles with a power cord. It blocks out the real world and ushers in a virtual one.
Welcome back to KFM 98.2. This is Derek with your nightly news dish. A police operation.
The first thing you hear in this 10-minute experience is chatter coming from a clock radio. It's in the corner of a rundown apartment with rundown furniture. And then a voice explains that you've just been laid off and you need to sell your couch and TV or you can't make rent. Then the world shifts, and you're living in your car. You spin your head, and the virtual world spins with you. In the back seat, all your possessions in a pile. Suddenly, in the driver's window, there's a flashlight. It's a cop telling you you can't sleep here. On it goes, this first-person look at how someone, really anyone, can become homeless.
We want to see if having this intense, emotionally arousing experience could change the way you think and the way you act towards the homeless.
Elise Ogle of Stanford University helped design this content. It's one of a growing number of virtual reality or VR worlds aimed at changing attitudes and increasing compassion to pulling off that Atticus Finch trick. Jeremy Balinson runs Stanford's Virtual Human Interaction Lab, which is researching these social good experiences. He says the reason VR can work like this is because of the deep immersion you get. Put on the headset and you get lost in a way you generally don't when watching a movie or reading a book.
The front of your brain tells you over and over again, this is not real, it can't be real. But the back of your brain, the one that's charged with basic survival, it can't differentiate. And if it looks real, if it sounds real, it treats the experience as real.
This is sound from another virtual reality tool. It's a combat simulation primarily designed for soldiers battling PTSD. Skip Rizzo with the University of Southern California helped develop it. He says it's not just for former soldiers, though. Their family members can also benefit.
And it kind of opens their eyes to what it was like for, you know, their loved one to have to go through a wartime conflict. When they're riding in a Humvee and all of a sudden an IED goes off and people start screaming and there's gunfire with tracer firing coming from a building, all in VR, all of a sudden they have a little bit of a deeper sense of what their loved one has gone through.
You can read about the battle for Fallujah in the Times or watch the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan and get a feel for what war is like. But VR can take you to the next level, a truer experience. Exactly what that experience does for us in terms of emotional processing and learning and behavior change isn't yet fully understood. And it's unclear how long the empathetic response, if any, may last.
I mean, we've had, 100 years or so of psychology as a science studying human behavior and interaction in the real world. Now we've got to spend a good bit of time studying how humans behave and interact in the virtual world. So we've got a good bit to go, but I think the research will bear fruit.
Creating video games in virtual reality may still attract most of the investment dollars, but there's clearly a push to use this technology for social good. To that end, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation recently awarded Stanford a $300,000 grant to continue studying its homeless scenario. And the United Nations put money behind what's perhaps the gold standard right now for this type of VR. It's a short film called Clouds Over Sidra, about the life of a 12-year-old girl inside a Syrian refugee camp.
We have to play football quickly because there are so many kids waiting to play. Especially now, unlike home here in Zaatari, girls can play football too. That makes us happy.
That project's director, artist Chris Milk, spoke about the potential for the technology during a TED Talk.
So it's a machine, but through this machine, we become more compassionate, we become more empathetic, and we become more connected. And ultimately, we become more human.
More human through shared experience, through stepping into someone else's skin for a while. It all sounds like fiction, but it feels like reality. For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman.
So perhaps virtual reality goggles to literally step into someone else's skin to be virtually in another race. Stay tuned. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.